Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This week on Truth and Movies, we pass judgment on the Ruth Bader Ginsburg legal biopic On the Basis of Sex.
This little soiree is our way of saying welcome.
Then we cross-examine the Cannes Jury Prize-winning drama Capernaum. And in Film Club, the 1998 disaster epic Deep Impact is in the dock. Was its poor box office performance a miscarriage of movie justice?
Look at the bright side. We'll all have high schools named after us.
All rise, it's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. It's Michael Leader here, seeking critical counsel from Hannah Woodhead from Little White Lies.
Hey.
And Eleanor Lazic. Eleanor, welcome back.
Thank you.
So Hannah, it's been a while. Seems to be a while anyway.
Yeah, it's been 3-4 weeks.
I've not seen you since you went to Sundance.
Yeah.
So deliver the final word on Sundance for us.
It was very good. It was very cold. Best thing I saw was The Souvenir, the new Joanna Hogg film. Trailer's just come out. It's going to be out in May, I think, in the United States. So hopefully same time over here. Really, really beautiful film about love and loss. And there's going to be a second one. She's doing a sequel. Okay. It's been planned as a two-parter. And yeah, it features Tilda Swinton's daughter, Honor Byrne Swinton. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. In her first like film role. And she's like, magnificent. So yeah, keep an eye out for that one.
The Souvenir. Can't wait to hear more about that. But let's get to this week's films. Up first, we have On the Basis of Sex. Felicity Jones stars in this biopic of US Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The film focuses in on a landmark case that in the early 1970s kick-started the battle against gender discrimination and launched Ginsburg's legendary legal career. But first, she must graduate from Harvard Law School, where in the 1950s she was one of the few women in a class of 500 men.
This is only the sixth year women have had the privilege to earn a Harvard Law degree. This little soiree is our way of saying welcome.
My wife, Harriet, and I are very glad all nine of you have joined us.
Let us go around the table, and each of you ladies report who you are, where you're from, and why you're occupying a place at Harvard that could have gone to a man.
Sam Waterston there is Dean Griswold. Possibly the villain of the piece. Hannah, you wrote the review for On the Basis of Sex. Tell us, is this a timely biopic? Should we care about Ruth Bader Ginsburg? And does this do her justice?
No, we should definitely care about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's this larger-than-life figure in kind of US political, legal culture and pop culture now. She's become this sort of unlikely pop culture icon. She is nearly 90, I think, mm-hmm. and this firebrand, tiny Jewish-American woman who's just kind of, I think, I'm struggling a bit because I watched the Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary on my flight back from Sundance, which is a very, very good film, also out pretty soon, if not already out.
I think it's already out. It's called RBG.
It's called RBG, mm-hmm. and I'm struggling to remember what was in that and what was in this. This is a film that's been in the works for a long time. They've been, you know, sort of saying, oh, we should make a Ruth Bader Ginsburg biopic. In fact, I can see from the notes that Natalie Portman was going to be in the film originally. Mm-hmm. And also, that to me makes way more sense as a casting choice than Felicity Jones. Right. I mean, Natalie Portman is Jewish and has been very sort of vocal about representation of Jewish women in film, and then they cast Felicity Jones for some reason. But yeah, I think, you know, there's a market for it. I just don't necessarily think this is the film that she deserves or the film that I deserve as a fan of Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Why do you say that? What's its deficiency?
It's very rudimentary. I think it's a very, like, a potted history. It's kind of going from her days as a law student facing down Sam Waterston, who's doing his best kind of like, I'm the sheriff in these parts and you're a woman. And so it goes through that all the way up until, it's about like a 20-year period mm-hmm. it covers. It's quite a long time. And there's a lot that's kind of like glossed over. So I don't want to get into like a history lesson about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, mm-hmm. but there was this very strange period where after she finished law school, she didn't graduate from Harvard. She had to move to New York because her husband got a job in New York. So I think she graduated from Columbia. I might be wrong. Mm-hmm. Ah, I was right. anyway, so she graduated from law school and then couldn't get a job. No firm in New York would hire her, despite her having graduated top of her class because she was a woman. So she had to teach law. And then that's how eventually she ends up getting involved in this sex discrimination case, which changes her life and also the kind of face of sexual discrimination law in the United States. But they're just trying to like do a lot in this film. They're trying to kind of cram in everything and kind of go for that real like mass market, like, if you don't know who Ruth Bader Ginsburg is, this is the only film you need to watch. And it's just, I think it needed to be more focused and more kind of, you know, woman in the city tries to have it all is like such a kind of old, you know, boring.
There is a middle
thing.
Section here which almost feels like it could be Mad Men for Women in Law or, or Miss Maisel from Amazon
yeah.
series. There's a pretty, you know, interesting scene there where she's going for a job interview and, you know, the guy interviewing her says, you're a woman, a mother and a Jew to boot. And just seeing that she's got this, you know, triple issues yeah. against her. Eleanor, what did you think of this film? Was this ticking
yeah.
boxes for you?
I haven't watched the documentary. I didn't really know much about her, so mm-hmm. that was really interesting. I especially love the ending when we get to the actual case that she does. That was the most
yeah.
thrilling thing for me. And to go back to what you were saying about how it's a movie that does a lot, it's just, like, I totally agree with you, and I think that's a problem in the film, because you watch this and it doesn't necessarily all really hang together. Obviously, it's all about sexism. But that's just because, as this woman, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she encountered an insane amount of sexism because of the choices she made and know who she was. And the movie tries to, like, put it all in the film, and you're like, well, actually, if you... I mean, it's incredible that she managed to carry all that on her shoulders, but the movie itself, I don't think, has what it takes to handle all of it. And so it just feels kind of... There are scenes that try to address those sexist issues, but in a way that... I think in a more realistic film, it would feel more like a pervasive thing that she's aware of and she's just dealing with every single day of her life. And here it feels like there are scenes to illustrate one aspect of sexism. And every time she's like a little bit surprised and a little bit more disappointed. And I'm like, I don't believe that that's how Ruth Bader Ginsburg is. I think she's just very, very aware of how it's everywhere. And then there aren't like little scenes where she learns something. And I'm just like, that's why it makes it a very like Hollywood type film where they try to have these really big scenes where she either gets humiliated or she like power walks out of a room after like saying something really sassy. And it's just like, well, actually would have been fun, not fun, obviously horrible, but like interesting to see the reality of living in that society. Because I don't think the movie really shows that as like a really realistic, pervasive, like sexism that would be so... I can't even imagine living in a situation like this where every single day you wake up and people like treat you like this. So yeah,
it paints in broad strokes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It comes off to almost like a primary school history lesson.
Yeah,
there's not much in the way of complexity to it. You know, we mentioned Dean Griswold, Sam Waterston. He's very much played as a villain, and there are these characters that are portrayed as equally good or bad. And they focus in so much on the home life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her husband Martin, who's played by Armie Hammer, in possibly the easiest, most woke role you can take, because Martin Ginsburg is a dad who has a job but is supporting his wife. Every line he says is, "You're amazing. Go and do it, honey."
And every other line is, "How was your day?" I don't know if you've noticed how many scenes start with him saying, "How was your day? What did you do today?" They're like at least like five or something. I couldn't stop noticing.
I found it so funny that this is clearly an awards position performance for Felicity Jones, but Armie Hammer is just happy being the best dad and husband in cinema history in this. I'd like him to give me a pep talk. Hannah, what do you think of Armie in this?
Okay, right. So, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Martin Ginsburg have like one of the most kind of romantic stories, I think, you know, that just, they are an absolute joy as a couple for me. Like, they met at college and he was like smitten with her and thought she was just the best. And and this film is very much like that, you know. It's just this guy who's just like, God damn, I'm the luckiest man in the world. And like, and I really found that very charming. But yeah, it's kind of like, am I a legal thriller or am I a romance film? And maybe they should have just like picked one, because I think there's enough in their kind of romance that would be an interesting film about a very supportive husband who kind of has everything handed to him on a plate. You know, he, I think he went to Harvard as well.
They both did, yeah.
And he becomes one of the best tax lawyers in New York, and, you know, everything just seems to come quite easy for him, whereas she's there just like drowning in sexual discrimination, anti-Semitism, and I think that would have been an interesting film as well. Armie Hammer, I think, you know, he does a good line in looking tall and handsome and slightly vacant. And one of the things I do find quite funny about this film in general is it so clearly on paper should have been like an awards contender. And just in reality, it's just, you know who's giving the best performance in this film? It's Justin Theroux.
Oh, do you think
he
so?
He is like going for gold as this kind of, what would you say?
Well, he's Mel Wolfe, the historical figure. He's the head of the ACLU at this point. And Ginsburg is petitioning him to add their name, their huge kind of civil rights lobbying name, to the case. Yeah. And he's just tearing apart all scenery around him.
Yeah, he's like chewing it up, you know? And he calls her Sookie. And it's never really explained why. If you watch the documentary, it does go into why they call her this. But he's just like, the first time he sees, he's like, Sookie! Like, bellows it across the room. And I was like,
That scene didn't really fit into the film. The scene where they meet for the first time in the film, I was like, what?
And it's kind of implied there's like a history there. And, and she's like, oh yeah, we go way back. And I was like, what?
But how? And what happened? Like, yeah, I think he's great, but he's got this really fake looking moustache.
Oh, yeah,
so
the
distracting.
The
and
mustache.
I was just like, why? Just, it's not hard. Just like, make it better. I don't know. And also, I think he's the most interesting character because he's the most like complex. Like he's obviously on her side, but he also knows the law and he knows what can work and what can't work. And yeah, so he's more interesting than most others.
His thread is what was most, in some ways, most intriguing for me, because the ACLU at that time was very much on the side of Black Americans and that struggle for civil rights. And his question for her is, how is this as important or more important than that fight?
Yeah.
And the film doesn't really pick into that.
I don't think it does. I think it's like, and that's an argument for another day. Yeah, I think that is the most kind of relevant to today's society, this idea of like picking your battles and like what should we be angry about. And I think my favorite scenes in the film are like the ones where he goes over to their house and they're kind of coaching Ruth for the trial, and that's where the kind of real energy is in this film. Like, you know, seeing him like push her and push her buttons, and it's just so desperate to be this real like life-affirming like you go girls like film, and it could have got more meat on the bones, you know?
And I think there's this one really interesting line in the film where I think it's the Justin Theroux character who says that if you lose this case, you set a precedent for them to basically make sexism like even more law than it is. And that's really fascinating from his perspective, because actually this is what happened with a very famous case. I forget the name now, but I just read about it like yesterday, that basically confirmed segregation laws in America in the 50s. And this is exactly what happened. Someone tried to go to court for the same thing, like something that was really unfair to Black people, and they lost. And so therefore this set a precedent for every similar case later to say, well, they lost in this case, so therefore you can't win this time. And imagine being in that situation. It's such a huge danger when she's doing this case in the film. And it's only mentioned very briefly in the film, but it would have been so like interesting to talk about it more, because it would really give the sense that of the challenges of this case. Not just like, is she going to do it? Is she going to say the smart thing? It would be like, if she doesn't, history will be so different in a terrible way. And it would have been nice to see more of that.
Perhaps more compelling as a legal thriller than anything else, but you have to wait some time to get there. Let's put some scores on this, Hannah.
I think it's maybe threes across the board. It's quite hard for me to be extremely critical of this film, because, you know, I always like to kind of champion films directed and written by women. Although this was written by Ruth's nephew, I believe.
Exactly, Daniel Stiepelman, yeah.
But, you know, it's great to see Mimi Leela getting her dues, getting to make another kind of high-profile film. That being said, of course, you know, I'm a film critic and my duties to the film. But it is just all very GCSE history lesson kind of vibes. It's not a film that I could ever see myself watching again, mm-hmm. you know. And, yeah, I think you're just kind of left maybe wanting more from it, more of anything, really. More romance, more legal thriller, just pick a lane.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Eleanor?
I would say sort of the same thing, but I don't know if I'm that positive about it because I feel like it's such an important and incredible thing that she's done. And I think the movie sort of almost trivializes it by making it so Hollywood. And I think that's very dangerous because it plays into the idea that, oh, yeah, like, you've done this, now we're fine. Like, actually, we're not. I mean, we know that things could go back to be very, very, very terrible. So at the same time, it's a movie that's going to probably teach a lot of people about this thing that even happened. Like, I didn't even really know about this a few months ago. But at the same time, I'm afraid that it might, like, sort of trivialize her and also make her this, like, very empty icon thing, which I like. Yeah. It's just, can you please stop talking about her this way? Like, it's very embarrassing. Like, she worked so hard. Let's not say, like, oh yeah, RBG, like, icon, like, well, my role model stuff. I mean,
there,
like,
is
go this, to school or something.
There's,
you know,
this interesting prevalence in America, and I think a lot of people have talked about this, like the memification of politics and turning political figures into kind of, like, you know, just these empty Twitter memes and things. And it's important to remember with a film like this, it's not ever going to be the whole story. And also, like, the Supreme Court traditionally is a very kind of conservative place, and it's hard to really be progressive when you're a Supreme Court justice. And obviously Ruth Bader Ginsburg did a lot, and I think she's a lot more kind of liberal than a lot of Supreme Court justices. But I think to get a better picture of the way that the American legal system works and kind of how sort of conservative and right-wing it is, maybe watch a documentary about her. Mm-hmm. I think it gives you a fuller picture of what's going on.
Okay. Well, yes, I agree. This is not really the biopic maybe this figure deserves. I'd probably say in anticipation three and probably twos, both enjoyment and in retrospect, it comes across as failed Oscar bait.
Really,
to me, and we've had a few of those over the last few weeks. Hopefully,
it's that time of year, isn't it?
Luckily, spring is coming, and the superhero movies will be here before you know it. But that's That's on the basis of sex. Up next, we have a Cannes Prize-winning drama called Capernaum. In a Lebanese courtroom, a young boy named Zain is suing his parents for bringing him into the world. In flashback, we see the events that led us here, from Zain's poverty-stricken upbringing to his attempt to run away and start a new life for himself, free from his family. This film premiered at Cannes last year and took home the jury prize, but Little White Lies' own David Jenkins says it's like a feature-length charity appeal, only less fun. Now, Eleanor, you don't have to agree with David, of course, but tell us about this film.
So we stay with this kid called Zain, who's about 12. I mean, we don't even know for sure because he doesn't know when he was born. And he lives in Lebanon, in basically the slums. Mm-hmm. And he's got, I think, about 6 brothers and sisters and parents who are not very nice, kind of violent. Basically, they just have no money at all, and he always has to try and make money some ways, like selling fruits on the street or selling anything that he can find, really. Then one day his sister, who's like very young, she is about to be married off to some much, much older man who's probably in his late 20s, 30s, but apparently that this is a thing in Lebanon and other countries, like poor countries. And Zain doesn't want this to happen because obviously she's basically a child. And his attempts to prevent that set off an incredible adventure that's kind of not in a positive sense. Like, he just has to struggle even more to survive because he decides to leave home and to set off to leave all these people who have just never been good to him and to try and have a better life somewhere else. And it's not as easy as it sounds. This is not a Hollywood film. So this is pretty harrowing portrayal of what it's like to live on the streets in Lebanon as a 12-year-old.
And it's told is this very much street level film with non-professional actors. No. The actor that plays Zane is his actual name.
Yes.
He gives this incredible unschooled performance, doesn't he? Of he owns and dominates every frame of the film.
He's incredible, especially because he's not even, obviously he's not an actor. Mm-hmm. And Nadine Lebecki, who I interviewed actually, she told me that this shot insane amount of footage, and she had like a 7-8 hour cut of the film. Mm-hmm. And there were so many good moments, obviously, because it doesn't take very long into the film to realize that this is an incredible child whose every moment on screen is just so honest and raw and incredible. And obviously she told me that it was like very hard to cut down the film to 2 hours because there were so many beautiful, incredible moments of him on screen, and that alone is such a pleasure in this film. Is he's just so incredible. You can't help caring about him. But also, I want to go back to what David said, because I think saying it's a feature-length charity appeal ad is very unfair, because I think, to me, a charity appeal ad is you see this child who's very poor and he looks at the camera and you feel bad for him and you want to pay money, like whatever, this is the thing. There's this notion in those ads of like, you're overing a little bit. You're like, look at this poor child, he's struggling, but he's looking at you right now. And in the film, there's not a moment where we feel so separate from this kid, Zane. On the contrary, like, first you see him, you might be like, what's going on? Because it starts in the scene where he is in court, he decides to sue his parents for giving birth to him. This isn't a spoiler, this is the plot, because he hates being alive so much. Mm-hmm. And you're like, what is happening? But then immediately you go back to the beginning of his story and you're so close to him, you're with him on everything, every little trouble that he has every day, like, how do I make money, how do I wash, how do I help my sister, how do I do all these things? So it stops becoming this sort of charity appeal ad aesthetic. It's just like, what is it actually like to be on the street every day? It's not like, oh, there are problems in the world and poor people who don't have anything to eat. It's like, you're on the street, what do you do? And I think that's so much more almost valuable, I think, than a charity appeal ad, because it's like, we always have these excuses, like, what can I do? You know, I'm only away. Like, there are systemic problems of, like, why these people are poor in this world and wars and stuff. And then in this film, they're like, okay, stop. You're with this kid. He has nothing to eat. He doesn't have anything to wash. What do you do? Mm-hmm. He just wants money. Uh-huh. It's not hard. And that's what I really loved about the movie. It's like, it's from the perspective of a 12-year-old child, doesn't know about politics, doesn't know about anything. He only knows is he was born, and from then on, his life sucked. And now he doesn't want to be alive. And you're like, well, yeah, I mean, from the perspective of adults or anyone who knows anything about, you know, the society, you're like, well, it's more complicated than that. But for him, it's not more complicated. It's like, I'm just alive and I hate it. I don't want to be born. Don't give birth to me. And I think there's value in that. It's not saying you should agree with him and this is a solution, but it's like, I don't know.
It does.
Sorry, that was like a really long rant,
no.
It's such a complex problem and I want to do it justice.
It's a good rebuttal to David Jenkins, whose review you can read on the website. Mm. But it does have this strong, it's coming from this tradition of cinema of empathy, where you are very much living with this kid for 2 hours and seeing him go through all these experiences. But it does have an issues movie layer on top of that, where it is looking at these undocumented people living in slums who are just having kids they can't provide for. And I have a feeling there is a certain didacticism later in the film, maybe. Yeah. Hannah, where do you land on all this? Is this film that worked for you? Did it move you?
It's funny you say that, because I tweeted last night saying it left me quite cold. But I think that David Jenkins has been rightly dragged for that statement on social media.
Has
as
he?
Well as, yeah,
good.
A couple of people have tweeted and said that's a very unfair assessment of the film, and I think it is unfair. I think there's not a lot I can say in addition to, like, no, it was, you know, you were completely on the money. It's quite unfair to the film, but also it's an oversimplification. And anyway, I'm not going to second guess David's opinions about this film.
What's your opinion, Hannah?
My opinion is the kid is great. I like that he's thoroughly unsympathetic at times. Mm-hmm. The way he talks is hysterical
so
to me.
Rude.
He is so rude. He's got such a little, like, a foul mouth on him, like the things he comes out with. But that's the reality of it. I know kids who are 12 who talk like that who aren't living on the streets. If anyone has a right to be a rat bag, it's this kid who's just kind of like, his life is just relentless misery and he talks like Al Pacino or something. You know? It is kind of amazing. It just didn't really do very much for me. I'm dead inside. This prompts the question, am I too kind of dead to this sort of thing. You know, mm-hmm. every single day I read the newspaper, I go online, I see images of this thing. And maybe that's on me. You know, I've become desensitized to this and I should be resensitizing myself. It does kind of open your eyes, I think, especially it's very easy to turn off. And if you make a conscious effort to go and watch this film at cinema, then, you know, you're not turning off, you're engaging with it. And I think it is, you know, that for me is valuable, this idea that cinema can transport us and show us something so different and so far removed from our experiences. And I do really like that Nadine Labaki has so clearly, like, positioned Zane's experience. It's not like, you know, kind of looking at him like, oh, this poor child. It's more just like, this is happening right now and this is what's going on, this is the way it is, you know. And it doesn't kind of fall into the very, like, much on the basis of sex. It's not sentimental. It's not, oh, everything's going to be okay for this kid. I think you kind of leave and you're like, you know, kids like Zane, a lot of the time it doesn't work out, you know? You don't just get happy ever after. That's not the way of the world. It's not like Annie or Oliver. This is like, you know, this is the reality. And that I found refreshing. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say negative things about this film. It just didn't work for me on an emotional level, and sometimes that's what happens.
I think one, I just want to ask one thing, because I think going back to what you said, I think, yeah, it's true that it's not in this Hollywood way, because you could totally expect a movie like this where the child has all these problems, but he's a child. Therefore, he's happy and he loves, like, you know, playing in the street. And this isn't that. This is a child who's like, yeah, I could be happy if I had, like, food and could wash, but he's not this child who, like, the minute he gets something sort of nice, he forgets his misery. Like, he's way more realistic than that, and you don't get to be like, oh, he suffers but he's happy anyway because he's got friends and family. Like, no, he's miserable, and there's no escape from that. And it's not this kind of, like, movie where you're like, oh, poor people, you know, they find a way. Like, they don't. And that's what I really like as well. That's why it makes it, I think, interesting in a way that maybe other films about similar topics aren't, because it's like, yeah, you are forced to stay with him the way he perceives it, and the way he perceives it, it's not like, oh, you know, we get by. No, it's like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Let's put some scores on this, Eleanor. What do you make?
Well, for me, I don't know, like, when I didn't really know anything about it when I went to see it. I saw it in Cannes first, 3, I guess, and then I think 4, and then 5, actually, because I rewatched it and I liked it even more, because I was afraid that I would rewatch it and be like, oh, you know, I was a bit, like, swept up by it. But actually, I rewatched it and I was like, this works, this makes sense, this is amazing. And this is like, it's such a good film as an answer to all these films that, I think it's so easy to watch a film like this and be like, well, actually, this is all based on liberal guilt and stuff. And I don't think it's that. I think it's like a genuine portrait of being in this situation, and I think, yeah, it doesn't give you answers, it doesn't tell you what should we do about this, it doesn't even ask you for, like, your money or anything, it just tells you what it's like to live this way, and I think that's so valuable.
Hannah, the cold-hearted opinion.
No, I think that Eleanor's assessment is very fair, and it's one that I think I will go back and rewatch at some point and see if I'm just kind of in a funk at the moment where I'm not responding to it. Because, again, like, you know, some people I very much respect have come out with, like, very, very glowing reviews of this film. There's something interesting here about, like, what connects to us as critics.
Yeah, I think, like, it's totally fair to, like, I think I can totally imagine me even later or something, or someone else watching this and not be as moved as I was, but I think that's totally fair.
Yeah, but no, I mean, yeah, it's threes across the board.
Threes across the board.
Today I'm just like, three, everything's a three. Everything's fine, cinema's fine. But yeah, Nadine Labaki, very, very talented woman, and I hope she has a long and lustrous career in film.
Yeah, I didn't know what to expect with this. I hadn't seen her previous two films. It didn't leave me cold, but everything that I appreciated in this film reminded me of the craft behind it. Like, I was looking at Zane, I was thinking, this is a brilliant child performance. I was looking at the way that Nadine Labaki had been handling these scenes shot in real locations, thinking how well managed this all was. There is an incredible scene, and, well, incredible performance, I'd say, from a toddler in this movie.
Oh, yes.
Which
one of the
might
best
be
babies
one of the best babies in cinema history,
screen,
I'd say.
Yeah.
So there's a sequence where he's given some cheap milk and he takes one sip and is like, what? You give me this?
So good, that bit.
I'd say that, having got a baby myself, it hit me even harder this time. But I would say the film as a whole was momentary interest for me. Mm-hmm. So probably 3-3-2, my scores. But divisive round the table, I will say. So that's Capernaum in cinemas this week. So we've had A film about a judge, a jury prize winning film. Up next we have an executioner in the shape of an asteroid, maybe?
How long have you been working on that one, Michael?
Just for the last 10 minutes.
Just the last 10 minutes.
So we have Deep Impact for Film Club.
That was amazing, seeing that unfold in real time. Wow.
She's more of a justice than a judge, isn't she? Never mind.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
An asteroid is hurtling towards Earth, and a NASA program to drill into its surface and detonate a nuclear bomb is humanity's only survival. Nope, this isn't Michael Bay's Armageddon, it's Mimi Leader's Deep Impact. Based around a similar plot, Deep Impact took a more serious and much less macho approach to the material, following the impending extinction-level event from the perspectives of a young stargazer, a TV journalist, the President of the United States, and the crew of the Messiah, led by old-timer Robert Duvall.
How many nukes do we have left in the bag?
Four.
If we can get the remaining bombs in that vent, there shouldn't be anything left of that comet bigger than a suitcase. Now, we can't do anything about the little one, but, you know, it just might give them a chance. Now, without the Army codes, we're going to have to wait to set the bomb timers until we get closer to Earth to raise Houston.
We may not have enough life support left to get back into the cargo bay for the nukes, much less to work down on the comet.
We sure as hell don't have enough propellant left in the Messiah to maneuver with. How are we supposed to get back off the surface once we've gotten down there?
We don't.
Hey, look at the bright side. We'll all have high schools named after us.
So a clip from Deep Impact there, which didn't win the Battle of the Box Office in 1998 against Armageddon, but how has it aged? Do we have any tweets, Hannah?
We do, yeah. I was tweeting about this film the other night, just kind of first reactions. I'd never seen it before. And my friend Kimberly replied to my tweet and said, the meteor sequence... I'm doing this from memory now because I've lost the tweet. He said, the meteor sequence gave me nightmares as a kid or something.
Until the age of 10.
Until the age of 10, yeah. There was a really harrowing tidal wave sequence in this film. Read that tweet from Cam,
was
I wasn't expecting it.
He was too young to watch that if he had nightmares until he was 10. That meant he watched it before he was 10. That's insane. Don't do that.
Yeah.
If you have kids under 10, do not show them this film. It's traumatic. It's very, very upsetting. Don't do that.
Yeah, it's very depressing. It's a real, like, a meteor is going to hit Earth and we're all going to die.
And that's it.
And that's it. That's the movie.
It's such a fascinating film now. First of all, that the actual sequence of the tidal wave that's caused by the impact is so pre-9/11. You see tidal waves crashing through New York of people being swept aside. There's an incredible shot of Washington Square Park where there's old guys playing chess.
There's a guy who's in the middle of reading his newspaper and I'm just like, why are you doing this? You knew the meteor would hit at this point. You chose this to be your last moment. I guess it makes sense.
But I suppose it's just following through with what is a downer of a movie. There's an hour in here where hope is lost.
Yep.
And it's about the Earth, or specifically America, who doesn't have much of an international purview, coming to terms. What will they do? What infrastructure has to be put in place to... Mm.
They're all quite rational about it. I'm sure there'd be a lot more like weird sex parties if like the end of the
and
world
also,
was
like,
announced.
Like, you know, like religion stuff. There is usually in this film, there's always like people in the street screaming, Jesus is coming, or this is the judgment. And there wasn't any in this film. Actually, that's a very odd thing. There should be one.
That's an alternate cut. I think.
Sex or religion in this film. But what is in this film? Was it the first watch for you two?
What did you make of it?
Yeah, I was aware of this. I think there's an article. There is an article. I know there's an article on Little White Lies about the kind of battle at the box office from '98. I was quite young when this film came out, so I missed it the first time around. But it is like the most kind of 90s casting, you know. You've got young Elijah Wood with like the most hair in the world. Mm. You've got Robert Duvall kind of like swanning around. We were just talking off air about like how old he is in this film. Mm-hmm. So why is he in charge?
He's too old to go to space.
John Favreau, like, as this kind of young buck astronaut, Morgan Freeman as the president.
It's James Cromwell.
James Cromwell, yeah.
Yes, we forget.
Like half the cast of ER, you know. There's just a lot of things going on in this movie and a lot of subplots that kind of, because it is just like basically giving you an insight into all these different reactions and, you know, all these different things that are going on. Elijah Wood's trying to marry this girl he likes at school because he can get her into the bunker. Sorry. If anyone's ever seen that Simpsons episode where it's the end of the world, which I'm assuming was like inspired by this, and there's a bunker and, you know, Lisa and Marge get in and Homer and Bart don't. Anyway, that's unrelated. But there's this great bit in the film that I really liked where they announce the bunker, which is going to be where the people who are going to continue Earth go. And they say, if you're over the age of 50, then you can't come in. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, they're trying to get rid of all the baby boomers. I like the sound of this. And so, you know, Mimi Lila's all right by me. Uh-huh.
I find this such a fascinating film. We have kernels of a great film in here. The production history is that Steven Spielberg wanted to make this. Mm. And I think the whole Elijah Wood thread, the fact that you're the kid who, during your astronomy science class at school, you discover an asteroid that's going to hit the Earth and you become almost a national celebrity off the back of that. That is a Steven Spielberg film.
Oh, yeah.
Like, every time it cuts to the suburbs and he's riding around on his bike with his flannel shirt on and this James Horner piano theme comes in, it's really interesting. Apparently, most of that plot was cut out after test screening. So this film was originally more like 2.5-3 hours long because it is a throwback to The Towering Inferno, etc., films that had big ensemble casts and some central disaster that we look at through their various eyes. And you can see that Robert Duvall very much thought that he'd be getting a supporting actor nomination off the back of that. He's really throwing everything into every scene. But coming alongside Armageddon, which is the big, brash, macho Michael Bay film that set his career on its path, and just after Mars Attacks, the Tim Burton film which completely spoofs this genre.
Talking about films that gave you nightmares, Mars Attacks traumatised me as a child. Mm-hmm. I had nightmares for years about that film, way too young to watch. I think it's actually like, I don't know if it was a 15, but it's very violent, Mars Attacks.
It was the first 12 I saw in a cinema, and I wasn't 12.
So it was a 12. I was absolutely terrified of that film. Gave me nightmares for years.
I saw that film for the first time as an adult, and I was traumatised. It's very strange and upsetting.
Tom Jones, it's a very strange film. Sorry, it's a brief interlude for Mars Attacks.
So Deep Impact just feels very old-fashioned, almost on delivery.
Mm. Yeah.
When you've got Armageddon, which has, you know, all of the things that people go to Michael Bay for in that film, the pumped up macho action,
Ben Affleck,
big romance, Tyler. That has the, you know, a big power ballad song behind it. Yeah, Deep Impact is much more interested in people and infrastructures and politics. The fact that it has so many amazing scenes of people staring at 90s computer screens.
They're pretty good computers, actually. I was surprised because, you know, there are so many films where the computer is just completely unrealistic. And here I thought
it was pretty good.
Actually, this looks pretty realistic for the time. I think this is probably how the computers would work. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't like on computers at the time, but it didn't look like, you know, I was watching this incredible Dolph Lundgren film where he had, I forget what it's called, but there's a scene where the nuclear weapons are, you can control them with a computer, and you choose where you're going to fire them by selecting the country on the computer.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, that's probably not how it works. But anyway, it's not like that in Deep Impact. It's much more realistic. And actually, I read online that apparently Deep Impact is much more scientifically sound and realistic than, obviously, Armageddon. But at the same time, I feel like this movie, you know, you're talking about the 1 hour where there's no hope. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting to watch as a film. I was like, this is crazy. A Hollywood movie doing this? Where people watching in the audience probably are like, I want my money back. This is too depressing. But at the same time, I don't know if the movie has like what it takes to take something so hopeless and horrible and realistic and to handle it properly. Like, there's still all this like music and all these things, and I'm just like, I don't know if the movie's aware of how bleak what it's suggesting is. I was just like, this is so horrible and sad and plausible. I mean, you could all die right now, we don't know. And they probably wouldn't tell us if that was the case, you know. I don't think Morgan Freeman would be like, I was waiting to tell you about this because we wanted to wait if we could destroy the asteroid. He would just not tell us and we would all die. Yeah. It'd be fine. Easier. But yes, I don't think the movie's like got what it takes to really understand how grave the situation is. Like, it feels, it's not like unrealistic enough. Like, usually those movies, the catastrophe movies, they're more like, oh, this is a crazy like tornado thing. What? It's never gonna happen. And here it's like totally could happen. We don't control asteroids. And it could happen, you know.
We're talking about Deep Impact because it's directed by Mimi Leder, who also directed On the Basis of Sex, which is released this week. This at the time was her big shot at becoming the new Spielberg in a way. It was executive produced by Spielberg, produced by DreamWorks, and it was the biggest budget given to a female director in Hollywood at the time. We talk so much about Movie Jail and female filmmakers who, you know, she made this and made Pay It Forward afterwards and then sort of went away for a long time. But she's excelled in television during that time.
Oh, yeah,
And that might just have been, we've talked about two of her films and come out kind of mediocre on both. Maybe that's the best form
for
her.
Think... If you think about Deep Impact as like a character study, then it totally makes sense that she went on to do The Leftovers, she went on to do ER. So I think she really kind of found her groove working in television and getting to tell these like long form stories, which go over years in the case of ER. So I don't think this is a case of her, you know, kind of like being put in movie jail because she made a bad movie. And it made money, you know, it did make money, not maybe as much money as they thought it was going to make, but... It wasn't a flop at all.
It just lost out to Michael
Bay.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. We've all lost out to Michael Bay, you know, in one way or another. But yeah, I think that Mimi Leder's a really interesting case. I would be fascinated to know kind of what made her come back to do On the Basis of Sex after kind of so long out of the game in a lot of ways. What a remarkable career to have gone from Deep Impact to On the Basis of Sex. It just... Yeah.
I actually, you were saying this was going to be a Spielberg film, but I don't know if the Tia Leone character would be the main character in a Spielberg film. I mean, she's this woman who's a journalist, reporter who wants to become an anchor woman, I guess. And also there are all these scenes where she's working in the office and there's this other journalist who goes to, you know, the in-office care center for babies, what it's called?
Crèche.
Nursery? Yeah, crèche. In the office. I mean, this is 1998 Hollywood movie where you see a woman who's working and also got her baby in the office. And I'm like, I don't know if this would have been necessarily been in a Spielberg film, you know? And it feels like they tried to make her more the central character in the film, and it feels like quite significant that wouldn't be in a Michael Bay film. And I don't know if it would be in a Spielberg film. And so that's one aspect of it that I think was really striking to me and quite interesting. I'm just really, I don't want to make like assumptions about Mimi Leder's career, because I even watching just this film, I was just like, what happened there? Like, it feels so strange. There are so many different narratives going on, things that you see way more of, you see less, and you would think you would see more of the Elijah Wood character. It just feels like such a huge project that I don't know what the history was there, and like, I don't know.
And she delivered the film.
She delivered. I mean, yeah,
it's not even like
it's not a failure or anything. But I'm just, I don't know what how Hollywood works at this time. I don't know how it was for her. I don't know how, you know, because I don't want to make assumptions. But like, yeah, in any case, from an outsider perspective, she didn't fail, and she should be making more movies.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I think maybe not to compare it too much with Armageddon. I'd love to watch this alongside War of the Worlds, which is where Spielberg makes his disaster movie, and it's post 9/11, so side by side. You know, you don't see
also very hopeless.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, but it is human level, but it's the family level.
Reminds me a lot of The Day After Tomorrow as well, which I think that was kind of my deep impact. You know, that's the right age for me. Jake Gyllenhaal.
You brought him up again?
Every time I come on, I'm contractually obliged to bring up Jake Gyllenhaal.
Well, we'll have to see next time you're on.
I did have something else to say about that, but I've lost my train
You've
of thought.
You've gone all dreamy eyes. Well, that was Deep Impact. If you happen to watch it now, let us know what you think at the usual channels, at Truth and Movies on Twitter, at truthandmovies@tclondon.com via email, or at lwlies.com/podcast. We have a comment section there. Next week, we're going to be reviewing Fighting With My Family, starring The Rock and Florence Pugh. It's a wrestling movie. We have Hole in the Ground, a new low-budget horror film. And for Film Club, it's the 20th anniversary of Hideo Nakata's Ringu, the Japanese film that started off the Asian extreme cinema boom. Can't wait to rewatch that. Let us know what you think at the usual channels. It just leaves me time to say thank you to Hannah and Eleanor for joining me today. I've been Michael Leader, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.